Today is the day to wake, work, and win. Welcome to the Standard.
All right. Let's head over to Honolulu, buddy. Is the investigation into a deadly ambulance fire in Kilauea? How would you say that? So I don't get in trouble with all of our Hawaii.
Kailua.
Kailua.
Yeah.
I knew that. Yep. Gets underway. The Hawaii Firefighters Association said it wants its workers to stay out of Honolulu ambulances until the investigation is complete and safety measures are in place. An ambulance caught fire as it pulled into Adventist Health Castle Hospital around 8 p.m. during a 911 call for a 91-year-old man in serious condition. He died inside the ambulance.
Oh, damn. I'm glad I didn't open my mouth there because I was going to crack a joke.
And then, hold on. It'll get worse. The injured 36-year-old paramedic, a 10-year veteran, was initially treated at, so this was like the ambulance medic, taken to the hospital. And then
he was at the hospital already. Right?
Yeah, but they took him from that hospital to a emergency burn unit.
Oh, okay.
So the paramedic remained in critical condition as of the writing of this. And then so the HFFA president, Bobby Lee, said, we don't want our members in the back of an ambulance. And we hope that they put great priority on doing a preliminary investigation to find out exactly like what started this.
I'm thinking one thing that didn't help was the oxygen in the ambulance. That's probably, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you think of all the things in an ambulance that would, like, make that worse.
Oxygen
would be huge. Especially if it's like, I know that those house tanks, right? Like those big 4-foot
right.
big tanks be, you know.
I mean, I think you would hear it, but at the same time, it could just be one of the trees, you know, your little oxygen trees just open.
Well, if it's a critical patient, right, which this one was, this 91-year-old who was critical, they probably absolutely had oxygen on, which was filling the cab, right? Like it's not all going into the patient.
Yep.
So I looked up, I was like, man, how often does this happen? How often do these ambulances catch on fire? So, there were multiple fires in 2013, in DC and then in Myersdale in 2015, same thing. They had an ambulance catch fire. It's not horribly surprising. I mean, these rigs, depending on how, like what your staffing model is, they idle 24/7. And then they get run super hard, and then they go back to. I mean, they're never off.
We had a fire truck catch fire.
Really?
Station. Yeah.
At the station?
Yeah, 9s years ago. I think we also had one at 13s.
Whoa.
So we had two. I think there was some wiring issue. I actually think it was
because they were plugged in, right?
Yeah, but I think it was some aftermarket wiring work potentially. Like wires rubbing, you know. I don't know, but yeah, that's wake up to that.
It's brutal, right? So then, as a fire chief, you're like, hey, and I don't know the exact model that Honolulu runs, but it sounds like it's kind of like ours, where you have an ambulance service that comes and picks somebody up, and then you have the fire department respond. But I mean, like you said, it happens to fire trucks too.
So everything's grounded in Honolulu? It was?
Well, I mean, they still have ambulances on the streets, but they're fire chiefs. Like, you can't get in the back of those anymore. It's fucking brutal, man. Call 911 because your 91-year-old family member's sick and they get all torched up.
It's on fire. That's not good.
No. I'm curious to know, out of the stories that I read, I mean, they have fire extinguishers on them. You know, like, I wonder how fast it went from, and maybe it was the oxygen, right? Like, hey, we're having some smoke in the engine compartment, and then it just spread too fast involved, for you to even do anything about. What would you do in that situation? You're in the back of the ambulance, and you're like, smells like smoke.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something like, pull over, let's get out of here. You'd probably investigate. And,
well, this was,
and I would just imagine myself, I'd want to dive out and then pull the patient out and...
This was in the ambulance bay.
Right.
At the hospital. So it's like...
I don't know.
But you're like, your first thing is, I got to get this patient.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I don't really care about the ambulance.
No, obviously right? not. Yeah. Oh, Jesus, man. That'd be fucking brutal.
So, no cause? No?
I mean, this happened so recently that they haven't established that yet. We got a class coming up, Tom.
We do in October, October 22nd, 23rd, Fords of Basics.
I'm super excited. 2 days, pretty much going to be going back to the basics skills of firefighting, and then we kind of add a little bit of a twist on it.
Well, plenty of competition.
Yep.
Plenty of sweating.
Plenty of busting your ass.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. It's not easy.
Yeah.
But I think in the end, it's just the relationships you build over that 2 days. When you hit Sunday night and it's all over, it's pretty cool.
If you want to show up to a fire feeling confident, this is the class.
Yeah, I think this is a start of it, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to become this great firefighter just because you come to our class. But I think what it will show you is, hey, shows you some solutions to take back to your own department, your own crew.
And drill,
and it becomes a little bit more fun, a little bit more enjoyable.
Right.
I mean, we always talk about, right, that you enjoy this job a lot more when you're good at it.
Right.
And this can be the beginning of someone's path to get really good, or it can be a revisit of skills, you know, to kind of get back to those basics like we're talking about, to feel confident again, or it can just be for some guys, maybe they come in and they just get after it for 2 days and becomes like that reassurance, you know, like, okay, I'm still doing things the right way.
It definitely re-energizes you for the job. If you're feeling kind of like in a lull, of like, man, I feel like every day is the same. I'm not getting any better. I'm surrounded by people who don't care. I'm starting to get a little disenfranchised here. I think this class does a really good job of getting you back to where you need to be.
Yeah, we're going to have fun. And that's the thing. We got 30 seats available.
Not 30 anymore.
No. But we'll also have the host agency, South Adams Fire, is great. They'll have a couple crews there, so there can be a lot of action, a lot of things to do. You know, you can get as many reps as you want to get, and we'll stay as late as you want to stay, but it'll be fun. So
our Patreon members get a huge discount. So if you're looking for this class and it's not the right price, you can join our Patreon and
get $100 off.
Yep.
So if you join the Patreon and you want to sign up for the class, just get with us. We'll get you a code. Get $100 off. It'd be great. So can't wait.
Yeah, we'll have the link down below, and we can't wait to see you. All right, something a little happier.
All right.
Up to Alaska. Four friends hiking in Alaska rescued an injured woman and carried her down the mountain. It's pretty impressive, okay? So these four friends, they are firefighters in Ohio. So the friends from Mentor, Ohio, planned their backpacking trip to Denali National Park in Alaska for over a year. The group included two firefighters, Patchinger and Jason Soren, a firefighter paramedic named Gabriel Anania, and Brian Brown. They arrived on June 22nd, and this is them saying, "We figured we should probably do a light hike, something kind of on the easier side to get us going." The group picked Flat Top Mountain near Anchorage for its beautiful views. "We hiked to the summit," they said, "and the summit was absolutely beautiful. On their way down, they noticed a woman who was sitting there just did not appear right. The Tennessee woman in her 70s had hiked up to the mountain with her family member to spread her late husband's ashes. On the way down, injured her ankle and couldn't put any weight on it. It was 2.5 miles left of the mountain to get her down. We ended up doing just rotating, giving her piggyback rides between the four of us until they got her all the way to the ground." It's fucking awesome, man.
Yeah, how much did she weigh?
I saw the pictures, and, you know.
Normal?
Yeah, a couple stones, you know? I wouldn't say she was, like, the thinnest person. We'll put a image up here, but, you know, she was 71-year-old size.
Piggyback rides.
2.5 miles downhill. It's pretty gangster, dude. Yeah. So it got me thinking about cremation.
Spreading ashes?
Yeah, man. So, like, what would you say is the cremation rate of the U.S.? Like, how many people get cremated?
40%.
So in 1960, it was 3.5%.
Okay.
2018, 53.1%.
All right.
A lot of people choosing that one, choosing that way to go.
Costs a lot to get buried.
Costs a lot to get buried.
Caskets cost a lot.
Well, you can, in some faiths that don't condone cremation, you can get cremated, but you then have to be buried inside like a cemetery.
Oh, underground? Or like stored in one of those inside walls. The buildings, yeah.
I think it's a money grab, man.
It's a pretty good use of having a piece of land.
Making a cemetery?
Mm-hmm. Think about having a big piece of land.
You know it's never going to get built on.
Well, just dividing it. Well, that's not true because Cheeseman was an old cemetery.
What?
Yep.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Look it up.
There are ghosts out there now? You know they didn't get all the bodies.
No, because they still find stuff to this day.
Seriously, dude?
Look it up. Yeah. But how? Okay, so you own a cemetery. Let's just say you own a piece of land and you're like, I'm going to sell lots for people to build houses on, right? Well, now a lot sometimes when you pay a lot premium through builders, it could be like 10,000 to 50,000, right? I mean, I don't, what's a plot for, and then you want to reserve it for the rest of your family that's coming through.
Okay, let's look this up. For burial plot.
Look up like Olinger Cemetery.
All right. So this is between $2,000 to $5,000.
Right.
For a space.
Okay. To dig a hole. Now, they have to maintain the grounds. So, I mean, cemeteries are typically very, very well manicured, right? Right. But, I mean, you're talking a little tiny bit of land, $2,000 to $5,000 through that whole thing, you know?
It's not bad.
No, and then they have the buildings, right? They build a building and they do the wall. Well, that's not really taking up much real estate.
Right. So you're saying pound for pound, if you want to get
just based on the industry, I'm not going to say it's money grab. I'm just not going to go that far. I'm just don't want to comment on it.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. But I would think it would be a very lucrative business.
Totally.
Yeah.
Especially if you're saying that you can't go to heaven unless you're
what is that classified as? Is that classified as agricultural or is it classified as residential?
Oh, that's cold as ice, dude.
Yeah, come on. What do you got? You got some applause for me? I mean, I'm...
Oh, hold on. Oh, why can't I move
this? All right, forget it.
What Anyways,
with you?
Worth it.
Yeah. I mean, because that affects your tax rate, right?
Yeah. Also, like, what's it zoned for? You can't just, like, buy a plot of land and be like, this can be a cemetery.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think... If you had open land in the middle of a city and you're like, I want to make this a cemetery, I think a lot of residents would probably fight that. Even though it actually... It
always looks nice. Right? Your neighbors are always quiet.
Right. Yeah, right?
Yeah, well, you hope they're quiet.
I mean, they take care of their lawn.
Right.
Right.
Although, if you watch enough documentaries, aka zombie movies... You got to be careful.
Let's just say Halloween's going to be a long night.
Long night. Got to own one of them shotties.
Friday the 13th, yeah.
How long do you think it takes to get cremated?
Oof. Well, you know there's that mortuary that's right by
Fact. Station. We see the smoke.
The smoke's going. Like one body or how long do they run that oven for?
They only do one body at a time.
Oh, okay.
That's a part of my...
2 minutes.
2 minutes?
I don't know. I think that thing's hot. Ashes, dude.
Yeah, somewhere around 1,700 degrees.
Yeah.
It takes 3 to 4 hours, and then another 1 to 2 hours to process.
Wow. I would never guess that.
Once you burn off all the water, soft tissue, organs, skin, hair, the cremation container, i.e. like the casket, I guess they burn that too, according to this, what you're left with is just the bones. So when complete, the bones are allowed to cool to a temperature that can be handled and then placed into a processing machine.
That's the ashes?
Yeah. So it's not ash. It's bone.
It's like really soft.
Yeah. Because that's all that's left. Bone.
Damn.
Yeah. Let's say you were going to get cremated. Where would you want your ashes spread?
Ooh. I always thought like it'd be your most favorite place to be.
Yeah.
But at this point in my life right now,
yours would be the bathroom. You spend so much time in there.
Honey, could you just,
you're like, sweetheart,
just flush these.
Flush these down the toilet.
Just down the toilet. That's great. Yeah, great. Oh, man. I mean, really big fan of palm trees and pools. I really like that. But I mean, it's like, when I say palm trees and pools, I mean, I like tropical. I like, right. I like the beach. I like it warm, but I don't know. I don't really, I leave it up to my family right now.
Yeah.
You know, because so on a more serious note, but to relate that, you know, I lost my brother when I was 17. Just about turned 18. But each of us, the immediate family, did something with part of his ashes. So it was kind of cool. Like, I spread it on a pitching mound. I think I'm not sure where my parents took it, but I mean, people put it in different spots with what meant to them, you know? So, I mean,
so
that's
when they're in that
too,
place, like, they always think about them.
Yeah, and it's just, I think it's part of the healing process.
Yeah.
You know? So I think I'd be fine leaving it up to my family.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I would want to force them to go on a trip. Kind of like you're saying, yeah. A lot of my family's from Ireland. Like, maybe, like, hey, I want it spread back in the county that our family's from, kind of.
Even though have you ever been there? See, I'd want it to be somewhere that we went together, or I would think at least that.
Yeah. I don't know.
How about you tell them some off-base thing?
Like in Borneo?
So I want you to go run the Leadville 100 and put it at the top of Hope's Pass, but you have to do it together, and you got to meet a time cutoff.
And if you don't, start again.
Yeah.
How long do you think that the cremation's been around?
Was it ever illegal?
It's illegal in some religions.
Yeah, but was it ever? Okay. I don't know. How long has it been around? A couple hundred? No. It's got to be around 1,000 years.
Like a millennia. Yeah, they said, millennium. Said tens of thousands of years.
It's a lot.
It's a long damn time. Yeah. When the human skeleton comes back more than a cup of all-purpose flour, 6 to 8 pounds.
Flour?
That's the, that's like density that they described it as.
So it's flour? Bone flour?
Bone flour. Dude, that's a great band name.
Bone flour.
Bone flour.
Yep.
Would you ever think about putting them into space?
Sure. But I mean, it's...
You're like, whatever, right?
Yeah, whatever.
Well, for $5,000... This company, talk about a fucking racket, dude. For $5,000, they'll put your ashes into orbit, and where they'll stay until they basically...
They're going to burn up going into orbit. Come on.
That's exactly what this says. So they'll end up burning up when they come back into the atmosphere. So they shoot them up, your ashes rain down on the earth. Or...
Please don't spend my estate on sending my ashes to orbit to burn up, raining back.
Well,
down.
It's going
to
cost you $5,000 to.
Yeah, please
put
don't
you in the
spend
ground.
My estate on that.
Okay, I'll write that down.
Not you, but that's for my family.
Or for $15,000, you can launch them into space, where they'll travel into a great blackness forever.
Forever. Dun,
dun, dun. Yeah, what a waste of time and money.
Okay,
but I don't know if you're like a space nerd. I could see that like being. An attractive
yeah.
Go out, right?
You're
like,
an astronaut.
You could be an astronaut.
I mean, Neil Armstrong, maybe. You wanted his ashes back on the moon.
Ooh. I think we're going back there.
To the moon?
I think they're launching something soon. Been there, done that, man.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
We already won the race, okay?
Let's yeah.
Move on.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm going to play this. It's basically... Chief Ken Bailey noticed his crew was not motivated. Rather than using his own instincts to boost the department's morale, he decided to bring in the professionals. So some folks from the University of Texas Psychological Department came out to his fire department, and he wanted to kind of figure out why morale was so low. So I'm going to play this to you.
King says being a firefighter is a rewarding job, but when you're putting your life on the line every day, it can be scary, which is why having a team you can count on is always important. But at this station, it wasn't always like that.
I think we were paying adequate attention to our members. I think we were focusing on being technically competent, meeting the needs of the community.
Chief Ken Bailey realized staff morale was low and retention rates were poor. So he reached out to the University of Texas Psychology Department for help. And Alyssa Mrazek identified one of the reasons why.
One of the biggest ones was a lack of trust amongst crews.
To address this, they began to change things up.
One example is they started having more like friendly competition in the organization where the results for various skill assessments were known to everybody in the organization.
In an anonymous survey, they discovered over 90% of the team felt work conditions improved, including King.
I can see some light at the end of the tunnel.
Communication between the staff has also improved. While there are still things that need to be addressed, they're headed the right way.
I find that so interesting that adding competition where everybody knows the ranking of everyone else improve morale.
You know, when you are competing athletically, there can be a lot of subjectivity to like that. But even in like team sports where, you know, you have tryouts and cuts and all that, who starts, who's on the bench, that type of stuff. Really, like it's seen in practice, like seeing what people can do. And you also are evaluating the game. And sports like, say, cross country or track, anything that has a clock, like swimming, that's money, right?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, guess what? Trials are coming up. You want to make it past, you know, districts or state or, you know, even like Olympic trials. You want to make the Olympic team? Here's the time. Top three or whatever, however many they take. Nobody can argue that.
Yeah, but why do you think that when they introduced that to their firehouses, why did morale improve?
Well, like she said, there's this trust factor. You know, that's a big part of team. I mean, that's like one of the cornerstones of team is trust, right? And we talk about it all the time when we are working out or we're training or doing anything between our crew. You know, we're fortunate now, everybody trusts everybody. It's automatic, you know, but that any new person comes in our station has to earn that. And they earn it by just the suffering, the not quitting, the actual like getting better. You know, if you don't know something, being okay with it, you know, not trying to hide your weaknesses. That's a big part of it. So when you build trust, then I think people's performance goes through the roof. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think it does two things. It reminds people how much fun this job is because it takes doing fire ground tasks and adds an element of like intensity that's not normally there. Like, oh man, did you see what they did over at station 5? I bet you we could beat them. Right? Cool. This is fun now, right? Challenge or threat. It's no longer this threat of, hey, Chief's going to be out there. You know, now there's some trepidation. Well, like now it becomes fun again. And also it kind of reminds people of that competitive spirit that I don't believe is celebrated much anymore. Right? Like it's, hey, I don't want anyone to feel bad if they're in last place.
They lose or they, yeah.
And that's exactly what I think a lot of fire leadership thinks when it's the exact opposite. We want that. We want to feel like that nervous energy when it comes to competing against other
people. It gives you pride in your own crew too.
Totally. It gives you pride in your house.
It's okay to have friendly rivalries.
Yeah.
I think it's okay to want to beat the other crew into their first due, right?
Because then when you get on a fire, kind of
still can trust those guys.
It all goes, like that competitiveness goes away, but that like, all right, I know these guys are dialed, right? Yeah, I hear them coming in on the radio. Sweet. I know what those guys are capable of.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was such an interesting.
Pretty big move for, you know, Chief to, I mean, everybody knows in their department top to bottom when morale's low, right? Like, everybody's aware of it. They know.
Yeah.
To actually do something about it, because all you usually hear about is like, yeah, morale's low. Yeah. It's not getting much better. Yeah. They're upset this. They're upset of that. Well,
the beatings will continue until morale improves.
Yeah. Well, what are we doing to improve it? Who are we reaching out to? How are we trying to do that? You know? Sometimes I can see departments not having the resources to go out and do something like they did, you know, like, or.
Well, maybe not get people to come to you, but they can initiate trainings.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing with morale, right, is there's more than likely the work conditions are not favorable to the front line, and there's not support or there's disagreement on appreciation or how much resources they're getting or whatever, right, from the guys upstairs. Well, if you want to try to get support from these, you know, blue-collar workers, what do you think the best way to do that is?
Show them that you're a blue-collar leader.
I mean, we talked about it before, but the white shirts have got to go.
Oh, the visual, I am different than you.
That's already a barrier. And beyond that, it's not a hard thing for a chief to create buy-in.
It's easy.
So find the shittiest parts of the job that people are complaining about the most. And as a supervising officer, as a chief, as a battalion chief or whatever, even upstairs, go do that.
Go run a call. Go run a call. And write the report.
Go run a call and write a report. I've seen it done. I've seen what that does.
Right.
Because not you may not get buy-in to, say, the organization as a whole, but you will get buy-in
on you.
On you.
Yeah.
Which, if you are doing a good job of balancing the needs of the organization, now you can ask this crew or this person to do some things for you. So now you are getting more production out of them.
Yeah. You know?
And we even talked about how big it would be if, let's just say...
We were doing stairs yesterday.
Yeah. It's like, if any chief showed up and was like, hey, next time you guys are here, call me. I want to do this with you. Okay? So the next time we go, we'll call you. If you were to show up, get in gear, and hike the stairs, it doesn't matter if we lapped you 5-6 times. It doesn't. It does not matter. You showed up. You're suffering. That's pretty cool.
Right.
And how fast word would travel?
You wouldn't have to do it every day.
No.
You just got to do it a couple times.
No. Right.
Yeah, I think it's sometimes you just want to like shake the staff and be like, what you're doing to fix morale is not working. So you need to try something else. And perhaps it's the opposite of what you're doing.
Yeah, it feels like it's hard to do what we're talking about, right?
It's not.
It's not. It really isn't. You just got to force yourself to think outside the box a little bit.
Get outside your comfort zone.
Get back to what, you know, what do you have in common with these people? Well, you were once doing what they did.
Right.
Do it together.
It's not that you're, like you said, it's not that hard. I think this is where people would get mixed up. And I say that because I'm trying to put myself in their position, right? I am upstairs and I'm like, all right, I'm getting word that morale's low. Well, we still need to put people on rigs. So we're still going to have to mandatory them. We don't have enough money for programs. We don't have enough money for all these requests that I'm getting.
Okay, let's go back to mandatory.
Okay.
Your line's pissed off about mandatory, right?
I don't know a fire department right now that isn't pissed off about mandatories. Right.
How could you just ease it a little bit? How could you make your conversation as a leader in the department get mandatory yourself?
Or
go just to the line and work. Hey, you know what? I'm going to try to help out these guys. Oh, you got mandatory for 12 hours? Guess I'm going to come in. I'm going to come in and take your last 4 hours.
You don't even have to do that. I had a chief in the Springs that would call the people who were mandatory and apologize. The chief.
Oh, the department?
Hey, I'm sorry you got mando today. That sucks. I appreciate it. That's it.
That goes a long way.
Takes no money. Now, granted, that only go if that happens
happening
every single year or every single day for like a year, well, that, okay, well, now that doesn't really make a whole lot of, that doesn't help me feel any better. But, hey, maybe we can let you choose what days you get mandatory. So, hey, here's where we're at. I got to get 4 people on a rig every single day. Here's how I want to do that. I want to make sure that, you know, sorry, Tom.
Give them
control.
Some, yeah.
Over their destiny.
Yeah.
Tom, you're going to have to work 2 overtimes this month. Pick your days.
Yeah.
Is that doesn't cost any money.
It's, it the hard part about this particular situation is you have no notice.
Right.
Right? We know our schedules years in advance, right? If we stay on the same shift.
Our families know our...
Everything.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, oh, 30 minutes before, nope, that's not happening. You're going to be here.
Yeah, one thing also I'm finding is interesting is I think it's hard for maybe some people to understand that men can be primary caregivers on their off days. Could you imagine a job telling a mother that she can't go home and take care of her kids?
Right.
That sounds like have fun with the lawsuit, but you can tell men that same thing and it's not like, well, what do you have to do today? Well, I got to go.
And everybody knows it too. The minute you get home, it's like, if you got young kids, it's like, here you go.
Yep.
You're like, oh, geez.
Especially like,
here we go.
I just worked a 48 and you come home and it's like, I got to go.
Right.
Yeah. Or, you know, how many people, their spouses work their own job that they have to go.
Yeah. It's only becoming a bigger issue too. So morale is going to continue to take a hit when you stuff like that.
Yeah. But there are some things that upper management can do to kind of quell the...
You got to get more buy-in. If you're going to do anything, you got to get more buy-in. I think it's an easy formula.